Whitehall, Glens Falls. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. This is Northern Light for Wednesday, March 27th. I'm Monica Sandresky.
And I'm Todd Moe.
The Adirondack Council is warning adventurous solar eclipse watchers to prepare for winter conditions on April 8th and avoid backcountry trails.
So they come here looking for that adventure, which is fantastic. But what folks aren't always prepared for is sometimes the remoteness and the trail conditions. It's rugged here.
Meanwhile, the Nicandri Nature Center in Messina has a full lineup of eclipse-related events.
Plattsburgh plans to use a big chunk of new state money to expand a full industrial park in town. The county's economic development director says new businesses means more jobs for the whole region.
That's important to Clinton County, but it's also important to people who live outside of Clinton County because those are opportunities that they can also take advantage of.
And we meet the writer speaking at St. Lawrence University tomorrow night. Beth Nguyen thinks a lot about why names matter. As a kid, she was relentlessly teased for using her given Vietnamese name. Then in her 30s, she decided to change it.
And I'd always wondered, would life actually be easier if I had a simple name that nobody would get wrong? And it's almost disturbing, my hypothesis that life is easier as Beth is true.
All that's coming up on Northern Light. Stick with us.
Broadcast of Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio is supported by Mountain Orthotic and Prosthetic Services, a full-service practice committed to providing care for patients of all ages with offices in Lake Placid, Plattsburgh, and Malone. Details and referrals at mountainonp.com.
This is Northern Light. I'm Monica Sandresky.
And I'm Todd Moe. The Adirondacks are expecting a massive influx of people to watch the total solar eclipse on April 8th. It's a beautiful place to see a once-in-a-lifetime event. But state environmental officials are urging people to enjoy official eclipse gatherings and stay out of the Adirondack backcountry, especially the high peaks. Conditions may still be winter-like, and trails will be muddy and dangerous. NPR's Brian Mann has this story.
Ben Brasso with the Adirondack Mountain Club walks along the shore of Heart Lake near Lake Placid. There's still ice on the water and on the forest trail.
We know that local officials are estimating about 170,000 visitors between, you know, the western edge of the Adirondack Park and the eastern edge.
That's a lot of people flocking on one day to one of the wildest places in the eastern U.S. Big crowds are also expected in the White Mountains of New Hampshire and the Green Mountains of Vermont. Which is cool, Brasso says, but there's concern that a lot of eclipse watchers won't be ready.
So they come here looking for that adventure, which is fantastic. But what folks aren't always prepared for is sometimes the remoteness and the trail conditions. It's rugged here.
This month, New York State Forest Rangers posted video on social media of a recent rescue in these mountains. Up high, it was freezing cold with blizzards. In the video, Forest Ranger David Nally described conditions.
This time of year, it's tough because you have to be ready for 3 feet of snow. You have to be ready for ice. You have to be prepared for mud. So it's a tough time of year to be in the woods, for sure.
That's what adventurous eclipse watchers could face on April 8th. Brasso with the Adirondack Mountain Club warns that first responders could be overwhelmed if a lot of people get in trouble at the same time.
If I slip and fall and twist my ankle, it's going to be a long time until someone rescues me. Do I have enough layers to stay warm? Do I have enough food to stay comfortable?
So those are two basic tips if you do plan to watch the eclipse in a wild place. Also, bring light, a headlamp, or a good flashlight, and tell someone exactly where you're going. If you plan to watch from a boat, remember, even if it's a warm spring day, water temperatures could still be treacherously cold. For more guidance, I checked in with Scott Van Lair, who was a forest ranger in the Adirondacks for 25 years. He says it's great. A lot of people will get outdoors for the eclipse.
I'm really excited for it. Personally, I feel like it's going to be like the busiest day of the year.
But Van Lair, who now manages a 40-mile network of rugged hiking and ski trails north of Lake Placid, agrees that people often show up in wild places without the right knowledge or gear. His biggest advice is stay off remote mountain trails during the eclipse. Across the Northeast, outdoor groups and state officials are urging people to watch from places that don't put them at risk. They point out many trailheads are reached by narrow, winding roads that can be treacherous in mud season. If you do decide to watch from a summit, Van Laer says you have to prepare for winter, even if it feels like spring.
If you're going to go into the backcountry, into the wilderness, what you see in a front country is not what you're going to have in a backcountry.
It's easy to understand why some people want to experience the eclipse in a wild place. On nearby St. Regis Mountain, there are amazing views of sky and distant peaks. But Van Laer's right. Up high, the spring-like weather gives way to a raw winter wind and a trail covered in deep snow. Brian Mann, NPR News in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
Brian's story first aired on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday.
Meanwhile, community organizations throughout the region are hosting eclipse-related events leading up to April 8th. The Nicandri Nature Center in Messina is putting on a series of programs to educate the community. NCPR intern Aaron Stickney reports.
Pretty much all of the North Country will be in the path of totality except for the Glens Falls, Lake George area. For about 3 minutes, the moon will completely cover the sun. And Tracy Thomas says she's so excited.
It's something we hear about, but we never get to see, you know, without traveling. So to have it right here, to be able to teach people about solar science, just an amazing opportunity.
Thomas is the executive director of the Nicandri Nature Center. She says they're hosting events in March and April to help the community know how to prepare. After all, it is a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence.
You hear the word eclipse and you might be thinking of the lunar eclipses or the partial eclipses that you hear about. But this won't happen again until in our area to like 2,399, I think it is. And so it's an amazing opportunity to get to see a phenomenon that won't happen again in many lifetimes.
Thomas says the big concern is the weather.
We are fingers crossed it will be a nice clear day so we get the full effect. But either way, we're totally obsessed with it right now.
The Nicandri Nature Center will offer eclipse-related lessons every day in March, Wednesday through Sunday, and every day during spring break, the first week of April. The lessons include what to expect when you're expecting an eclipse, Astronomy 101 for kids and families, and solar photography. For North Country Public Radio, I'm Erin Stickney in Messina.
We do have a lot of questions about the total eclipse. We know you do, too. So astronomer Eileen O'Donohue will join us here on Northern Light next Tuesday, April 2nd, to answer questions about how a total solar eclipse works. Get your questions in. Email them to news@ncpr.org.
Listening to Northern Light right here on North Country Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past eight. Good morning. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Just ahead, a conversation with writer Beth Nguyen about why she changed her name. She's coming to St. Lawrence University tomorrow evening to give a talk, and we've got a preview coming up in just a few minutes here on Northern Light.
And scattered showers in the forecast today. Highs in the 50s, near 60, light winds out of the south. Northern Light is supported by Fort de la Presentation, helping to educate and recreate historical ventures of interest to the St. Lawrence region, fort1749.org, and by St. Lawrence Nurseries, Potsdam, accepting orders now through April 12th for cold hardy fruit and nut trees. Details at slngrow.com.
More than 200 soldiers have returned to Fort Drum after a deployment to the Middle East. The 10th Mountain Division and the 2nd Brigade Combat Team hosted two welcome home ceremonies in the past week. The commandos deployed for Operation Inherent Resolve last July. Soldiers were on missions in Iraq, Syria, Jordan, and Kuwait. The goal was to prevent the resurgence of ISIS.
The state recently awarded Clinton County $3 million to help develop its former airport property. And as Kara Chapman reports, winning the funding may help put the county on the map for more businesses.
The Clinton County Business Innovation Gateway, CBIG for short, is located off State Route 3 in Plattsburgh. It's right next door to an existing industrial park that's currently at full capacity.
We could have more businesses here all the time, but we're running out of space. And this property provides a very unique opportunity to address that need.
That's Molly Ryan, Clinton County's Economic Development Director. She says there's a big demand for land that's available for development in the county, and this $3 million from the state will help address that problem.
What this award will help us do is immediately open up about 130 acres of land.
That's about a third of the 450-acre parcel. Ryan says the state money reimburses the county and closes the gap on a $6.5 million project to develop those acres. According to a press release from Governor Kathy Hochul's office, this portion of CBIG will be able to support up to 1.7 million square feet of industrial space. The state funding supports improvements to water, sanitary sewer, stormwater, and electric infrastructure, as well as the construction of a roadway. Ryan says that builds on existing advantages, like CBIG's proximity to the highway, rail, and the Plattsburgh International Airport. And she says getting the state funding also puts something of a spotlight on the site. It's now designated as a shovel-ready property through Empire State Development.
They're working with people calling New York State every day and figuring out where to set up shop in New York State, and now this is one of the locations that they will have on their radar.
As for opening up the rest of the 450 acres, Ryan says that'll depend on identifying additional funding sources, both private and public.
Obviously, we never want it to come at the, on the backs of the taxpayers of Clinton County.
Ryan says the project will benefit taxpayers by generating sales tax revenue and expanding the tax base. But she says the CBIG development isn't just about benefiting Clinton County. Ryan says new businesses mean new jobs available to other North Country residents.
That's important to Clinton County, but it's also important to people who live outside of Clinton County because those are opportunities that they can also take advantage of.
Ryan says the state funding ensures that this phase of CBIG's development will be completed by the end of the year. Kara Chapman, North Country Public Radio.
A liquid hydrogen facility planned in Messina is one step closer to construction. According to North Country Now, village trustees approved a plan to sell about $300 worth of water from the St. Lawrence River to the industrial chemical company Air Products and Chemicals each year to power the facility. Liquid hydrogen is a green energy source that can reduce carbon emissions and slow the effects of climate change. Governor Kathy Hochul has said she wants New York to become a regional clean energy hydrogen hub. Air Products and Chemicals will produce about 35 metric tons of green liquid hydrogen every day and employ about 90 people. Construction will begin this summer, and production is slated to start in 2026.
A Plattsburgh man has been sentenced to 25 years in prison after pleading guilty to first-degree manslaughter earlier this year. The Plattsburgh Press-Republican reports Michael Rougeau was one of two men who pleaded guilty in connection with the murder of Kenneth Dara at Ossiable Chasm a year ago. The other man's sentencing is scheduled for next month. Dara's body was found on the banks of the Ossiable River after being thrown from the Ossiable Chasm Bridge in Chesterfield. Police say he died from blood loss due to multiple stab wounds and blunt force trauma. Prosecutors say the men went after Dara because they thought he was providing information to the police about people they knew. In addition to the 25-year sentence, Rougeau will also have a 5-year post-release supervision when he gets out of prison.
St. Lawrence County legislators are asking Governor Hochul to fill seats on the Hermantown Board after a series of resignations earlier this year. North Country Now reports Hermantown Board only has one member after four people resigned in quick succession back in February, along with the town accountant. Without at least three board members, town business can't proceed. That could stall a $7 million water infrastructure project that's set to begin soon. The county's legislators are asking Governor Hochul to appoint at least two people to the board. With those two, the quorum could appoint two more members to fill the vacancies. Those appointed would hold the position until the election this coming fall.
You're listening to Northern Lights right here on North Country Public Radio. I'm Todd Moe.
And I'm Monica Sandreski. Coming up, a conversation with writer Beth Nguyen ahead of her conversation at St. Lawrence University tomorrow night. Then stick around after the show for Bird Note. It's the next installment of Bird Noir, Private Eye, coming up at 8:42. But first, Todd has a look at the weather for us.
Mild temperatures, partly to mostly cloudy skies today with highs 50s near 60, some scattered showers. Light winds out of the south, lows tonight around 40 with clouds. And then pretty much cloudy, partly to mostly cloudy skies right through the weekend at this point with highs tomorrow mid-40s, highs Friday and Saturday upper 30s, low 40s. Right now in Canton, clouds and 49 degrees.
Many kids, often from immigrant families, take on an anglicized name at school and use their given name at home. Vic Minh Nguyen's parents said, no, be proud of your name. Nguyen is a Vietnam-born, Michigan-raised writer who's giving a talk at St. Lawrence University in Canton tomorrow evening. As a baby, Nguyen's family fled Vietnam a day before the fall of Saigon in 1975. After passing through a series of refugee camps, they settled in Grand Rapids. Her given name is Bic, spelled B-I-C-H. Growing up as a refugee in a mostly white, mostly conservative community in the 1980s, she faced relentless, often racist bullying. You know what your name sounds like, right? That kind of thing. She says her name made her, quote, miserably visible. So as an adult, she changed it. And she wrote about it in a New Yorker piece called America Ruined My Name for Me. I caught up with Nguyen ahead of her talk tomorrow night.
My parents were very progressive. They were like, we're not changing for anybody. And we have to be who we are and we have to be proud. And they were ahead of their time, is what I'm saying. Because I agree with that now. But it did make my life really difficult back then. And I don't even mean to blame them. I think I'm blaming myself because I did not know how to be in the world as a person with a super Asian name that people were always getting wrong and making fun of.
At what point did you realize that your name meant something to other people that you sort of had to deal with?
My given name was immediately, as soon as I went to school, a source of conflict for me. My earliest memories of school are about being made fun of and having to learn how to endure it. I associated school with endurance. I still do, sort of, because I had to code switch so intensely and I had to pretend I was not Asian, which sounds really terrible and in hindsight was terrible. And then at home, very Vietnamese household, my grandmother lived with us and did pretty much all the cooking. And she was a great cook and made Vietnamese food all the time. Coming home was always a relief, an actual physical relief that I didn't understand till many years later. And that relief was not having to pretend I was somebody else. I didn't have to explain myself at home. I just was. And that kind of dual life is necessary for a lot of people, but it has a deep emotional cost.
Can you share a bit about that, about what that emotional cost was for you, is for you?
Yeah, I think the emotional cost has to do with not knowing what is real, what is authentic, who am I supposed to be? And growing up is so much about figuring out who am I, who am I supposed to be, and who should be telling me how to behave, you know. Racism was not something we talked about. Multiculturalism, that word, was not something we talked about. We all just tried to fit in and not have the difficult conversations that people have now about identity and selfhood and awareness.
You've said before that, like, growing up, you were pretty self-conscious and shy, but that a question you've sort of had to ask yourself is, was I shy or was I traumatized?
That question, was I shy or was I traumatized, is a question that has plagued me for years now. because there's no answer. And there is a back and forth relationship between those two. And I don't know. And I'm not even sure those things can ever be separated. But the trauma doesn't help. But what really doesn't help is not talking about it.
Were you aware of how race and ethnicity was playing into how people were interacting with you and with your name?
Absolutely, I was. But I did not have the language to explain it. That is the key difference. I felt it. I understood it. I could not have explained it to anyone. I could not have had not just the words, but the bravery to talk about it to anybody. When I changed my name to Beth, I was in my 30s. So I had gone all those years as a bit. And I decided one day to change my name and start going by Beth as a social experiment. And I'd always wondered, would life actually be easier if I had a simple name that nobody would get wrong? And then, you know, I was going to have children. And I wondered, are they going to have to deal with a mom whose name that people make fun of? So I tried it out.
What was that moment for you? What can you take me to that moment of the social experiment happening?
Oh, sure. So over the years, I had always experimented with different names. When, you know, when you have to go to a restaurant or somewhere where they have to ask for Starbucks and they ask for your name, I would always give a fake name for fun. Usually I would give a name from the Golden Girls. Rose, Blanche, Dorothy,
Blanche.
Sophia. And I decided it would be useful if I really were going to change my name to something really simple that also started with a B and that was as similar to my given name as possible. And it came upon me when I was in New York at a Shake Shack. And the person asked for my name, and I said, Beth. And all of a sudden, in that moment, I remember, you know, vividly, this feeling came over me at the Shake Shack. And I thought, oh, that's who I am now. Beth. It felt so legitimate.
When you started using Beth, what changed for you?
I felt more anonymous. And it's almost disturbing to say that my hypothesis that life is easier as Beth is true. It is so much easier. Nobody ever questions me about it. I feel easier. I don't feel as self-conscious. I don't feel the hesitation of having to introduce myself to somebody knowing I have to explain my name and spell it out. And then they're going to ask questions and they're going to think I'm some weird foreigner. All of that, you know, that's internalized in me. It doesn't come out as Beth. It, you know, one of the things I said in that article in New Yorker, that essay in the New Yorker, was that as Beth, you know, I'm not seen as a foreigner. I'm just seen as an American. And I feel that in my interactions with people that I meet and I introduce myself as Beth. It's just easier. And when I look at those interactions later, I do feel a kind of sorrow, a kind of sadness, a kind of complicated, why is life like this? But that is the work of life and writing, is to deal with those complications.
In the New Yorker piece, you wrote, I took on the shame of not being strong enough to handle the shame of the American gaze. What do you mean by that?
I mean that I felt bad that I wasn't strong enough to handle my given name. And I have received a lot of criticism for changing my name. And I was always told before I did start going by Beth that it was a weakness to change one's name, that it was a betrayal. That's why I didn't change my name. That's why I went 30 some years. I felt that I had to endure. I just had to be strong and, you know, be proud. And it actually took me all that time to realize I was being that person. I was being, quote unquote, proud, whatever that is, not for me, but for the approval of others.
Who was pressuring you to keep going by your Vietnamese name?
Everybody I asked. I would run this idea by various friends, people, strangers I would ask. Every once in a while, I would say, well, what do you think if I went by a different name? And they would all say, don't do it. Sometimes people got mad at me and they would say, I'll never call you by any other name. It was, I realized, much bigger than personal identity, much bigger than personal choice. It's about representation. And it brings to mind questions like, for whom, for whose gaze, and who gets to decide what we are called?
That was Beth Nguyen. She's the author of several books, including Owner of a Lonely Heart and Stealing Buddha's Dinner. She's speaking tomorrow night at St. Lawrence University.
Time is coming up on 27 minutes past 8. This is Northern Light here on North Country Public Radio. And just a reminder that our Howl Story Slams continue. Tonight, join us at a live storytelling competition at Olive Ridley's Tap Room and Grill on Court Street in Plattsburgh. It starts at 7 o'clock. Anyone is invited to sign up to tell a story tonight. The rules: has to be a true story, no notes, under 5 minutes, and the theme, risky business. No tickets. Admission is a suggested $10 donation. And so stop by Olive Ridley's Tap Room and Grill, Court Street in Plattsburgh tonight, 7 o'clock. And then, if you miss tonight, we'll be in Morristown in April on the 23rd at the Iron Horse Grill on Main Street in Morristown. Check it out, ncpr.org/howl.
So many events going on throughout the community, eclipse-related too. Lots of craft days related to the eclipse for kids, including in Saranac Lake. It's an open studio class to decorate your own eclipse glasses. Take as much or as little time as you need. Great for the whole family, they say. Participants under age 7 should have an adult. Cost is $15. You can find out more from ADK Art Rise in Saranac Lake. And also coming up today, this evening in Ogdensburg. The craft is make your own pinhole camera. That's this evening in Ogdensburg at the Ogdensburg Public Library from 5 until 6 o'clock. You can find out more from ogdensburgpubliclibrary.org.
Tonight in Tupper Lake, join Nature Up North at the Tupper Lake Sky Center and Observatory for an exciting night of stargazing and learning. You can register on the Nature Up North website, natureupnorth.org. That's tonight, the Tupper Lake, the Adirondack Sky Center Showcase starting at 8 o'clock. Folks from Nature Up North and at the Observatory, and this night of stargazing and learning in Tupper Lake.
And I want to remind everybody to check out the exhibit currently on display at the Downtown Artist Cellar in Malone. It's called Out of the Box, and it features a selection of women artists. It's put on by Support Women Artists Now. Todd did a wonderful conversation with curator Tina Lamour not too long ago, which you can find on our website, ncpr.org. That exhibit is on display through April 6th at the Downtown Artist Cellar in Malone. You can find out more from downtownartistcellar.com.
And that's it for Northern Light for this Wednesday, the 27th of March. We're back to Morning Edition in just a moment.
Then join us at lunchtime today for Fresh Air. We'll talk with New Yorker writer Tammy Kim about why Oregon's groundbreaking experiment with decriminalizing possession of hard drugs is coming to an end. In 2020, voters overwhelmingly approved it, but painful results generated a backlash. And we'll hear more between noon and 1 right here on NCPR. I'm Monica Sandreski.
I'm Todd Moe. Be well.